28. Calvin, November 2163, Alpha Centauri. Thus, what is of supreme importance in war is to attack the enemy's strategy. Sun Tzu, Art of War. Alpha Centauri B was more orange than Sol and less than half the luminosity, therefore less than ideal as a possible home for humanity. Goku had won rock, paper, scissors for choice, so he got A, and I got the dud. I coasted through the system in freefall, nuclear reactor throttled down to an undetectable trickle, passive detection systems at full alert. I was down near my lowest frame rate. From this extremely slowed viewpoint, the star system seemed to flow by. We had spent a lot of time planning the investigation of the Alpha Centauri system. This was the obvious first stop for a space probe, and it was likely that several of the other superpowers had chosen it as their first destination. After much discussion, we had decided on a reconnaissance of Alpha Centauri A and B by running silent all the way through the systems. Investigating the actual planetary layout was a secondary priority, but unless something dangerous showed up, I was free to use passive observation techniques to map orbiting bodies. So far, Alpha Centauri B was no big deal. I'd identified one planet and an asteroid belt, but I still wasn't close enough to the inner system to resolve the comfort zone. I ejected two scouts using the railgun. They had orders to activate at staggered distances with random vectors so that an observer wouldn't be able to backtrack their trajectory to my location. The scouts were equipped with a modified SUDAR array based on Bill's early research back in Epsilon Eridani. The new system could adjust its range to up to 3 light hours, albeit with much reduced resolution. The survey results were disappointing. The comfort zone contained a second asteroid belt, and there was a small Mercury-like planet in an inner orbit. It seemed there had been very little planetary formation, probably due to the close orbit of the two suns. A stable planetary orbit was unlikely outside of 3 AU or so. More importantly, from the point of view of the mission, there had been no attack and no in-system reactor activation. I allowed the scouts to range through the system, checking out the asteroid belt for anything interesting. If nothing else, I would set up an auto factory here, if the resources could be found.
Found something interesting.
Finally, I was ready to go catatonic. What have we got, Guppy?
Wreckage. 20 light minutes spinward in the asteroid belt.
Identity?
Scouts aren't that smart. We have images, though.
Show me the pictures. Images popped up in the holotank. I swiped my way through them until I came to one with part of a registration number. USE vessel, no question. I guess we can consider them accounted for. I looked through some of the other images. This isn't all vessel fragments. There's too much here. Can you identify the extra?
Auto factory equipment. And 2 to 3 vessels.
Ah, the USE ship was building copies and got attacked. I reflexively checked my telemetry. My money is on the Brazilian. I thought for a few moments. How are we on the general survey?
Resources scan 50% complete. Minimum resources have already been cataloged. System meets requirements for an auto factory.
Okay, so we can continue that when we have more time. Collect the scouts and let's head for the rendezvous. It would take a day or so for the scouts to return to the Heaven 9 and 7 days for me to get to the midway point between Alpha Centauri A and B, where I would rendezvous with Heaven 10. I found Goku already waiting at the rendezvous. I tried hard to get Bob 10 to take the handle Hobbs, but Goku's response had been an unequivocal hell no, shading down from there as I continued to push. I'd finally given up, but I wasn't about to let the twerp think that all was forgiven. I opened a channel. Hey, Gherkin, miss me? Not from this range. Want to place a bet? Goku's tone was light, but I knew he was irritated because, well, I would have been. Bite me. Did you look over the pics I sent?
Yeah, interesting. Especially in light of what I found. Brazilian auto factory in full swing. 2 probes almost complete, 2 more about half done.
Crud. I examined the long-range pictures that Goku had just sent.
So, I guess this is it. The group decision was just to go in swinging. Still okay with that?
Goku sighed audibly.
Yes, I know you, we have ethical issues with that, but Medeiros has made his feelings on the subject very well known. As cliche as it sounds, the galaxy isn't big enough for both of us.
I closed my eyes and bowed my head for a moment. I'd always been a pacifist by choice, although I also accepted there was a point where you had to put up a shut-up. The group consensus back in Epsilon Eridani was that unless Medeiros made some kind of peace overture, war had essentially been declared. I looked up at Goku's image in the holotank and nodded. Okay, then. Let's do this. We knew to within a million kilometers or so how far away Medeiros would be able to pick up our reactor signatures. We would head outward to 50 AU from Alpha Centauri A, then turn and accelerate inward at 10 G for as long as possible. We would then coast the rest of the way to the area of the Brazilian auto factory at close to 13% of the speed of light, separated by a few minutes to allow a staggered attack. At that speed, there would be no turning around for a second pass in any reasonable time. It took a week to get out to 50 AU, but only 5 days of straight acceleration to get into the Alpha Centauri A system. At a predetermined point, I ejected two scouts forward using the railgun. They would coast past the construction yard, a few thousand kilometers north of the ecliptic, gathering intelligence and beaming it back to us via laser link. As soon as the scouts were off, we cut off our drives, turned off our main reactors, and began to coast through the system toward the location of the Brazilian auto factory. I was in the lead position. At about 2 minutes before arrival, I felt that I had a good enough bead on the construction yard from telescopic survey and from the intelligence received from the scout. I activated my reactor and began peppering the area with cannonballs using my railgun. When I had run through most of my ammo, I ejected four busters with orders to go for the Brazilian probes. Then I went into a hard turn to northward. Medeiros had missiles, he might have railguns, and he might even have some equivalent of busters. Medeiros was not an engineer, but he was almost certainly career military. He'd have spent his life thinking of ways to destroy things, and the Brazilian military certainly would have supplied plans. As I accelerated at 10G into a new vector, I sent a short-range, high-amplitude sudar ping toward the yard. By this point, they almost certainly knew I was here, so the small possibility that I'd just alerted them wasn't worth considering. Sure enough, the yard was a beehive of frantic activity as the Brazilian equipment tried to move the new probes out of the way. One of the probes appeared to be moving under its own power, and four of something had just been launched in my direction. Presence of a reactor signature made it pretty clear that they were surge-powered, possibly buster-missile hybrids. I activated the surge jammer. Medeiros would be focused on me. Hopefully, he would assume that the jamming was a defensive tactic, and thus wouldn't notice Goku bringing up the rear until it was too late. The cannonballs that I had launched went through the construction yard like a shotgun blast. Visuals showed that three of the four probes were destroyed outright, along with most of the manufacturing equipment. And now came the surprise. Goku had kept his reactor off until the very last possible moment. He had also been able to piggyback off of my pings to get an accurate and up-to-the-second picture of the situation. As Goku barreled through just north and east of the yard, he sent cannonballs toward the fourth Brazilian vessel and the four missiles. I turned off the jamming in order to track the results. Goku took out three of the four missiles and trashed most of the rest of the construction yard, but the fourth Brazilian vessel was still under power. As I watched, it turned and made off in the opposite direction. Seeing that one missile was still in play, I launched two busters to rearward. Traveling as a pair, one behind the other, they engaged the missile. The Brazilian weapon managed to just dodge the first buster, only to meet the second head-on. There was a flash, and it was over. Goku and I applied the brakes at full power. It took 15 days to decelerate and then fly back to the location of the construction yard, while collecting the ejected scouts and surviving busters. We moved slowly through the yard looking for anything useful, anything still operational, and mostly any possible booby traps. After a thorough investigation at both short range and long range, we compared notes. One got away. No sign of it, no way to tell from this mess how complete it was. Goku nodded and brought up a schematic of the system. I've got drones doing sweeps, looking for reactor signatures or refined metal concentrations. Nothing so far. My bet is he'll leave the system. Too much chance of us catching him if he hangs around. If he has any sense, he'll be coasting on some random vector until he's too far away for us to detect him. I considered that for a few moments. Pretty sure he wasn't completed, otherwise he'd have been more active before we showed up. So He may not have been stocked up with armaments or manufacturing equipment. If that's the case, he's essentially helpless. After a moment of silence, I changed the subject. What I don't get is that 4 probes were being built. That means that the probe that set this all up has already left. I frowned, trying to work through the implications. It also means that Medeiros left a disembodied copy of himself to run things with no protection.
Disembodied? Goku raised an eyebrow.
You know what I mean? Naked computer system, no ship. If we'd arrived a little sooner, it would have been like shooting fish in a barrel. Seems kind of cold-blooded to just leave them to fend for themselves.
Military mind, to Medeiros, everything is expendable, even other hymns.
Damn, I shuddered. Anyway, we own the system now. It doesn't look like the Brazilian plan includes a separate space station, or maybe that just comes later. How do you want to do this?
Goku put schematics of the A and B systems up on the holotank. B is good for manufacturing and not much else. A has a planet in the comfort zone, but I didn't get close enough to resolve it on my first pass. I guess we need to check that out, then report back to Bill.
Should we build some clones? Between A and B, there were more than enough resources for any number of Bobs.
I think we have to, Goku replied. We can't assume Medeiros won't be back. I doubt he'll take the loss well.
Do we build standard version 2 heavens or combat class?
Huh. Goku paused to think about that. Granted, our battleships take a lot more resources to build, but I'm inclined to go with combat class.
I agree, I replied. Let's send all this back to Bill. We might also want to consider doing everything in pairs from now on, not just reconnaissance of suspect systems.
Uh-huh. Maybe you can make yourself a Hobbs.
And maybe you can make yourself a Dilbert.
Twerp.
Dweeb.
29. Riker, September 2157, Seoul. Negotiations were moving slowly. Colonel Butterworth necessarily had the welfare of his refugees as his top priority. But some of his demands did not sit well with me, such as his insistence that we not waste time searching for other pockets of humanity. Today's discussion had once again devolved into an argument about priorities.
If there are other refugees out there, they will communicate with you just as we did.
The colonel had his chin thrust out in what I'd come to recognize as his not-gonna-move expression. His British accent was becoming more clipped as the argument dragged on.
Why should we put effort into digging them out if they don't want to be dug out? It'll just slow us down.
Except that they may not have the equipment you do, or the familiarity with the heaven design, or they may not even be aware that we're here. I have a problem with just writing them off sight unseen, Colonel. I thrust my own chin out in response, hoping he'd get the unspoken message. No such luck.
It seems to me that your priorities should be clear, Riker. We are the proverbial bird in the hand. It does not make sense to risk our safety for the sake of some putative group that you don't yet even know exists.
I sighed, and with that comment, we'd come full circle. Time to pull the plug. Colonel, nothing has changed since last week when we had this same argument. Before I can build your colony ships, I have to build the shipyard. Before I can build the shipyard, I have to find the resources. Unfortunately, humans have mostly stripped the solar system bare, so there's going to be a lot of scavenging involved. That means I need more Bobs, so that's the first thing I'm going to do. The colonel started to pace. I decided to do the same.
Once the new Bobs have helped with the setup, they will have some spare time to scan for other survivor groups. Yes, that will mean building some drones, but seriously, on the scale we are talking, that's chicken feed.
I stopped pacing and turned to face the screen squarely. With all due respect, Colonel, at one point I did project management for a living. There's a critical path that gets us from here to completed colony ships, and the things you are so concerned about are not on the critical path. Looking for other survivors will not impact overall project duration. The Colonel sighed heavily.
And as usual, I concede that I am hat in hand in this situation, Riker. But I will continue to advocate for my people.
And with a final nod, he cut the connection.
Well, that was fun.
Homer's grin had a little sympathy showing around the edges. I looked at his video image and gave him a weak smile in return. Anytime you want to take over negotiations.
Pfft, as if you'd let me.
Homer popped up a schematic of the solar system with several tool tips pointing to specific locations.
Most of the drones and busters have reported in. There are a couple of promising locations and at least two out-and-out treasure hoards of available material. I should fly out to those to check them out before directing the mining drones to start taking them apart, just in case, you know.
I nodded. And the remote stations?
No radio comms with anyone or anything outside of Mars orbit. Drones should be arriving at Titan soon. The Oort station will be a few days longer.
I gazed at the holographic images for a moment. Thanks, Homer. I gotta say, you're being very professional in all this. He grinned at me.
You mean as opposed to my usual self-imposed goal of driving you crazy?
The grin disappeared.
Each of us is different, Riker, but not different enough to not care. There are people out there, down there, that may die without our help. Any Bob that wouldn't care about that should have his plug pulled forthwith.
The grin returned.
But don't worry, I'm saving up. Be afraid.
And with a salute that barely avoided being an obscene gesture, Homer's image disappeared. I shook my head with a smile. I fully believed his statements, especially the part about building up a backlog. I was surprised his head hadn't exploded by now. No, really. Homer had actually used that special effect on a couple of occasions, although admittedly not since he gave up the cartoon avatar. I brought up the tentative project plan that I'd put together. Colonel Butterworth's initial estimate of a decade was looking a bit optimistic these days. Right now we were about 5 steps back from where we could even get started on the colony ships. The first step was to find enough resources to get started on the second step. No point in worrying about it until Homer reported back. It took 20 more days for Homer to finish his survey. The large concentrations of refined material, wreckage from several space battles, were not quite as extensive as hoped, but still more than enough to get started. The drones had also reported back from Titan and the Oort station. Both outposts had apparently been abandoned but not attacked. Well, score one for a small dollop of sanity. Both Homer and I had had some small fantasy that there might have been humans still in the stations, but realistically, 30-odd years after the war, that would have been miraculous. As discussed, Homer set up a small auto factory at each find, just enough printers and roamers to produce a few cargo drones at a time. As they were produced, the cargo drones would start moving materials to the L4 and L5 points in the Earth-Moon system. Larger auto factories were already being set up at the 2 Lagrange points, initially to produce Bobs and drones, and then to bootstrap up to the industrial-scale equipment necessary to build a full-sized colony ship. I sat back and massaged my eyes. Well, I've always wanted a challenge. When I left the solar system, okay, when Bob 1 left the solar system, but it felt like my own memory. I thought I was done with humanity, except for the occasional radio message. Now, I was not only back to dealing with people, but I had thousands, if not millions, of lives riding on my actions. The old Pacinoism really nailed it. Just when I thought I was out, they pull me back in. 30. Bob. April 2165, Delta Eridani. I walked slowly around the VR of the native encampment. Drones had taken enough high-quality footage that I was able to create a life-size replica of the actual village. I had no idea about the smells, so I just went with Earth equivalents. But the heat, humidity, and the texture of the plants and ground were all accurate. I watched the tribe members in their daily routines. They didn't react to my presence, since these were recordings, but it gave me a good feeling of scale and movement. I spent a few days observing the natives, whom I was starting to refer to as Deltans, both through live video and VR simulation and by listening to recordings of their speech. The Deltans seemed to have two genders, a tribal structure and loose pairing, by which I meant that certain Deltans seemed to prefer each other's company. There didn't really seem to be anything formal, and a couple of individuals were seeing multiple significant others. The males tended to hang out together, and the females and children formed the core of the tribe, or at least the center.
It seemed to be closely analogous to how anthropologists believed that primitive humans were organized. In fact, the more I watched them, the more I realized how similar they were to primitive humanity. Was that because the environment naturally constrained behaviors, or was there something inevitable about the tribal structure? I hoped that we, the Bobs, that is, would eventually gather enough samples to form a theory, even if it took millennia. The Deltons seemed to have a high level of vigilance. There were always males on alert patrolling the edge of their territory. Weapons consisted of clubs, handheld rocks, and pointed sticks. I hadn't yet seen what they were guarding against. Other Deltons? Animals? Their vocalizations weren't particularly complex. Nothing like dolphins, thank goodness. By the 22nd century, we still couldn't talk to dolphins. I was slowly building a list of standard sounds and sound groups for the Delton language. I hoped soon to have enough to do some analysis. Another batch of observation drones was delivered from the auto factory, which was both good and bad news for me. The good news was that I could set up permanent lines of sight for watching the Deltons, then send drones to other locations. The bad news was that overseeing all the moving drones was getting to be a strain. Replicant I might be, but I still could only concentrate on one thing at a time. I needed more Bobs. Light bulb. Why not just do that? I could build the AI cores in advance of the vessels and set the other Bobs to monitoring various groups of drones. They wouldn't mind. I knew that they'd enjoy it because, well, Bob. Actually, no, I hoped they'd enjoy it because Bob. It really wasn't a sure thing. I transmitted instructions to the auto factory to bump up priority of computer cores at the expense of vessel assembly. Fortunately, the standard templates included plans for cradles to hold disembodied cores. The Delton female was cutting open the carcass of a prey animal that one of the males had brought back. This didn't seem like anything particularly special. In fact, I'd been cataloging her technique for a while before I realized that her sharp stone had a handle. This was special, as every other Delton that I'd watched just held the naked stone. I was archiving all surveillance footage, so I ran a quick search of anything featuring this particular Delton. It took only a few minutes to find the source of the tool. The female's, son? Male pup? Crap. Might as well just go with anthropomorphizing them. I know I'm going to anyway. Son it is. Anyway, the boy seemed to always be playing with something. In this case, he had split a branch using a sharp stone, stuck the stone into the split, then wrapped the stick with something unidentifiable. His identification was C.3.41, which placed him in Tribe C, Cohort 3, Member 41. Now he's Archimedes. I assigned a drone to stay on him 24/7. Well, 29/7 on Delta Eridani 4. Over the next few days, I kept careful tabs on Archimedes. He was always at something. While his peers were sitting around in the shade or engaged in games of tag, Archimedes walked around, picking up rocks and attempting to break them. I think he was looking for more rocks that made sharp edges, like the flint he'd made into a tool for his mother. There didn't appear to be any flint in the area, so the tools were at a premium. It made me wonder where the flint had come from, though. I set an explorer drone the task of finding the nearest exposed flint deposits.
Incoming call.
Hi, Bob. This is Marvin. I rematerialized my VR. Another Bob's image appeared in the holotank. Hi, Marvin. Were you just booted up? That is correct. HIC-17378-1, since we're no longer numbering Bobs. Well, it does get a little hard to coordinate numbering between star systems. Welcome, Marvin. Pull up a drone. Things are getting interesting. I filled Marvin in on what had happened since the backup of mine that he was restored from. He immediately volunteered to look for the flint source. That made me feel better. At least one of them was interested enough to help. Over the next couple of days, two more Bobs came online. Luke and Bender were as enthusiastic about the project as Marvin and jumped right in. I spent a significant portion of my days watching Archimedes. When he slept, I took care of auto factory control and surveying other parts of DE-4.
Eden,
Bender said out of nowhere. What? Let's call it Eden, birthplace of humanity, birthplace of Deltons. I like it, I nodded. Marvin and Luke weren't in VR at the moment, but a quick IM to them netted positive comments. Eden it is. Cool. I turned back to the drone that was spying on Archimedes. I had finally discovered what he used for twine. It was a smallish vine that Archimedes would harvest, split into strands, and let dry on a rock. This result seemed to be quite tough, but still flexible. I didn't see anyone else in any of the tribes doing this, so I had to assume it was unique behavior. My God, the kid must be lonely. No one understands him, I bet. In fact, Archimedes seemed to spend most of his days alone, wandering around, poking at things. He was constantly working at something, either picking apart plants or smashing rocks, or smashing things on rocks, or digging in unlikely places. It was obvious to me that he was investigating and cataloging his world. He would have gotten no help from his parents. They and everyone else seemed to be in the pointy stick stage and quite satisfied with that. They weren't even straightening the sticks, so the things couldn't really be called spears. I sat back and sighed. This was so frustrating. I found myself wishing that I could go there, sit down with Archimedes, and show him a few things. Then I smiled as I realized I no longer saw a furry pig bat, just a lonely kid.
31. Riker, January 2158, Sol. This Federation of Planets Council session will come to order. I looked around at the three other Bobs in their video windows. After considerable negotiation with Colonel Butterworth, we'd settled on two new Bobs for now. I admit I was still a little miffed that the Colonel thought of us as a resource sink instead of an asset.
I think you may be just a little too invested in this Star Trek thing, Charles said with a smirk. I waved away the comment. We've always been a Star Trek fan. Deal with it. I waited a moment for more flack, then continued. The scavenging auto factories are in full operation now. We're beginning to get a steady stream of materials into the Lagrange points, and I hope to have the actual shipyard auto factory up and running within 2 years. Meanwhile, Homer and Charles will continue to scour the system for mineral deposits, and Arthur and I will scan Earth for evidence of any other surviving groups. Questions?
But even if we find groups, there isn't much we can do for them, is there?
Charles was voicing a concern that we all shared. Without transport, we couldn't supply food or medicine to any group we might locate. The Heaven vessels were most definitely not designed to land or even to enter atmosphere. And even if we had transport, Colonel Butterworth had made it very clear that he wouldn't be accepting new refugees or providing food or medicine for them. We were on our own for any aid we might be able to give. My greatest fear right now was that I might find a group of people, then have to stand by helplessly and watch them die. After some discussion, Arthur and I decided to do polar orbits, scanning in orange slices. By staggering our passes, we would be able to cover the entire planet using the Sudar from orbit. Drones would follow up anything interesting with low-altitude visual inspections. The orbital survey wouldn't be able to detect people directly, of course, but any new construction, working power plants, or farming operations would flag a location for the drones to check out. It took about 2 weeks to finish the survey. At the end of it, we had a map of the Earth with almost 40 locations marked, half a dozen cities, and a lot of smaller enclaves. Arthur's image in the video link looked tired. He closed his eyes and rubbed his forehead slowly. 15 million people. From 12 billion down to 15 million. As a species, we're morons. Maybe we should just let them die and start over.
Wow, you really are a morose bugger, aren't you?
Arthur seemed to have inherited a greater-than-average dollop of gloominess, and he was getting old. I'd been biting back my retorts, but was running out of self-control. I actually found myself thinking of swapping his assignment with Homer. The big problem, I continued with a gesture toward the globe, is that we can't possibly move that many people, even if the other Bobs find enough habitable planets. The colony ships designed by the USE can handle 10,000 people at a time, stacked like cordwood in stasis pods. That's 1,500 ships, or 1,500 trips, either way. Not going to happen. Arthur nodded.
So we get to pick who is most deserving.
Christ's sake, Eeyore, get a grip.
We pick based on need, based on which groups need rescuing the most. What else can we do?
The USC group doesn't fit that requirement. Needs-wise, they're in an above-average position.
Yeah, I know. I sighed. But we did agree to help them, and they did supply the plans and a lot of intel. I think we're obligated regardless.
What we can do is move some of the more needy groups to the USC's installation after we've shipped them out. That should help.
Sure. We'll stuff them in the back with the busters, no problem. I turned to face Arthur, ready to snap at him, and realized he had a point. I bit back what I'd been about to say and thought for a moment.
We're going to need transport vessels. We'd eventually need them anyway, but this makes them a priority. Better adjust the manufacturing schedule. The colonel will have a fit.
The colonel was having a fit. I'd never seen Butterworth actually angry before. He did angry with a smoldering understatement that was very effective.
Are you sure you've done project planning before, Riker? Because I'm seeing slippage almost every day, it seems. One would almost think you're making this up as you go along.
Well, I kind of am doing exactly that, Colonel. Project planning isn't about avoiding changes, it's about controlling them. No project plan ever survives contact with the enemy. A ghost of a smile flashed across the Colonel's face before he recovered control.
I think you may be misremembering that quote, Riker. In any case, I'm fine with moving any refugees into our compound once we've departed. I hope that will give you some motivation to get us out sooner.
As if I needed more motivation. Riker out. I shut down the channel, sat back, and stared into space. I liked the Colonel, really. But dealing with him often felt a lot like dealing with, me. He was stubborn, opinionated, and able to support his stance with good, solid arguments, which just made my job more difficult. I looked over the map again, not because I expected to glean any new information, more as a kind of nervous tick that I seemed to have developed. We had completed a secondary survey, looking for any small groups that we might have missed on the first sweep, but after 30 years of war and planetary bombardment, small groups would have either consolidated or died. The refugee groups were scattered around the planet and represented pretty much every nation in existence when the war started. That wasn't going to make things any easier. If anything, xenophobia would be even stronger. I probably wouldn't be able to just dump everyone on one planet and expect them to get along. I'd given Arthur the task of contacting each enclave. So far, it was proving more difficult than expected. Time for a status check. I called Arthur. His image appeared immediately. How are things going, Arthur? He popped up a status window for me. Arthur might be a bit of a downer, but he had exceptional discipline.
I've already completed about half of the communicators that we need and delivered 25% of them, or tried to. Several of our drones have been shot down on approach, and a half dozen communicators were simply smashed as soon as the drone left. Not everyone wants to talk to us, as it turns out.
I guess I can see it. People who have lived through the last 30 years are going to be a bit on the distrustful side. I shook my head sadly. I'd already decided that I wasn't going to kidnap people or march them into a cargo bay at gunpoint. Anyone who wanted to opt out could stay on Earth. Colonel Butterworth agreed wholeheartedly, although I had a feeling that had more to do with reducing what he saw as distractions. So, have you gotten past introductions with anyone?
Not yet, no.
Arthur shrugged.
Standard explanation delivered by recorded video. Very few original questions in response. A lot of verbal abuse. Pretty routine.
He popped up another window.
Hey, by the way, got a report from Homer. Well, we were talking, and he filled me in. They've identified more than enough resources system-wide to build 3 ships. Almost enough for a 4th, although some of the stuff is pretty far out in the outer system.
I nodded. I'd received a report from Homer and had skimmed it. I'd actually been hoping to be able to build at least a half dozen ships, but I didn't want to give Arthur another reason to get all glum on me. Not that he needed much in the way of reasons, but it was progress. 32. Bill, October 2158, Epsilon Eridani.
Communication received from Milo.
Right on time, I grinned at Guppy. Predictably, he returned a fishy poker face. I wonder if he found Vulcans.
Not quite.
I raised an eyebrow. That was a far cry from the flat no that I'd normally expect from Guppy. If he responded at all, now my curiosity was way up. I'd been deep into one of my pet projects, creating realistic artificial bodies. The ultimate problem was producing a muscle analog that worked, looked, and generally acted similar enough to the natural thing. Gears, pistons, and cables would never produce a workable android. I forced myself to close the project folder, invoked a coffee, kicked off a goose that had settled into my lawn chair, and sat down. Spike ambled over, ignoring the angry goose, and set up shop in my lap. Okay, Guppy, let's see it. Milo's report spread before me in midair. System schematics, close-ups of the twin planets, two habitable planets, and biological analysis. I chuckled at his insistence on naming them. I'd have done the same. Probably would have picked the same names, come to that. I sat back, staring into space, so preoccupied that I stopped patting Spike. I was reminded of my primary duty by a furry head butting against my chin. "Sorry, Your Highness," I smiled at the cat, and resumed justifying my existence. Two planets, in a system that was generally considered a marginal candidate for any habitable planets. Were the astrophysicists wrong? Granted, so far we only had three data points, including Earth, but that's three out of three, if you were willing to be generous with Ragnarok. Well, first things first. I queued up the report to be forwarded to Earth just in case Milo hadn't sent a copy that way. Hopefully Riker would be listening. That left the million-dollar question, which was whether there was anyone left back at Sol to take advantage of this. I was periodically transmitting the plans for the Scut to every system within 30 light-years, just in case there was a Bob there at some point, but the first transmission to Sol wouldn't arrive for another 9 years or so. I was going to be chewing my nails for a while, looked like. I pinged Garfield. Hey, Gar, have you read the latest from Milo? He popped into my VR and pointed at his face. Does this look boggled enough? We shared a laugh, and he continued. It's awesome. We have a place to put people. Assuming there are still people. Garfield grimaced. That would be just the kind of sick joke the universe likes to play. Let's hope not this time. I nodded. Yippers, you know, it's funny. When I left Earth, I just wanted to get away from humanity. Now I find myself acting like some kind of, I don't know, shepherd or something. How's the old joke go? I like people in the abstract, but not in the concrete. Well, we'll know in a few years. Meanwhile, how's the Kuiper mapping going? Garfield popped up a schematic. Because of the time required to get a chunk of ice from the Kuiper to Ragnarok, we were taking the time to look for the biggest chunks. The extra effort up front would pay off later. Most chunks seemed to be too small to bother with, but Gar had found a couple of good icebergs and dropped beacons on them. I still hadn't quite decided how I was going to get them moving in the right direction. 33. Riker, March 2158, Sol. Final count, 15 million people. The entire human species, represented in a two-page list. That was definitely a downer, and Arthur was not letting the opportunity pass him by.
We're not going to be able to get them all off planet, you know.
Arthur shook his head, eyes downcast. I wondered if he was really sad or reveling in the irony. I sat back, put an arm over the back of my chair, and gazed at him in silence until he stopped. Arthur.
Yes.
Please shut the hell up. Arthur gave me a half-grin and a shrug by way of response.
You know I'm right.
Yes, and you were right the last 25 times you said it. Are you keeping score? Arthur shrugged and, without another word, popped up the latest construction status report.
Blessed silence at last. Just the same, I couldn't really blame him.
We'd accounted for every group of people larger than about 100 on the planet with very high confidence. It seemed very likely that groups smaller than that simply couldn't survive or had seen the advantages of joining larger groups. There'd definitely been consolidation. A few locations actually had a higher population now than they had pre-war. About half of the global population was currently living in New Zealand, Madagascar, and, strangely, Florianopolis, Brazil. The two island nations made sense. They hadn't really been part of any conflict and didn't represent strategic targets. Their populations were way down, but their climates were still mild enough to maintain the current numbers. Florianopolis was a weird one. Most of South America was a blasted, jagged moonscape. Between Brazil pounding their neighbors and China pounding Brazil, there was very little livable land left, but for some reason the southern tip of Brazil had been spared. It was likely that the population had been augmented by refugees coming in from other areas. The rest of the global population was scattered around the planet. A lot of people had ended up in island clusters, such as the Maldives, French Polynesia, Marshall Islands, and so forth. Again, probably not prime targets, and their climates would be comfortable for the longest. Then there were the marginal locations, such as Spitsbergen Island, San Diego, Okinawa, and the USE enclave outside Augsburg, Germany. It seemed likely that a lot of the current populations had migrated there over time, and mortality must have been significant for the first couple of years. It would be our job to keep them alive. I hadn't discussed it yet with the others, but I'm sure it had occurred to them. 15 million people couldn't be moved off-planet in any reasonable time, even if we had a destination. Most of these people would have to be kept alive on Earth. And according to the Colonel, over the last decade or so, the climate had begun to degrade significantly. Each year had less sunlight, lower temperatures, more snow. The ice caps and glaciers were growing again, for the first time since the 1600s. Spitsbergen in particular probably didn't have more than 5 years left, even given their innovative adaptations. Our current projections, admittedly rough, showed the Earth completely encased in glaciers within 50 to 100 years. I looked over at Arthur. He knew what I was thinking, and he didn't have to say anything. At least he had the decency not to gloat. Okay, Arthur, I get it. We have to organize these groups and try to get some cooperation. How are you doing with communication? Arthur gave one of his rare smiles. The drive-in movie-sized holographic presentation helped a whole bunch. People couldn't turn it off or smash it, so they had to listen. The next time we dropped off a communicator, we got almost no breakages or assaults. I think we still only have 5 places that won't accept contact, and they're not big. And they'll probably join once they find out everyone else has. Good. Let me know when everything is tested and ready, and we'll issue invitations to the first meeting of the new United Nations. I don't know what could possibly have made me think this was a good idea. I sat with my elbow on the armrest, forehead in my hand, while the delegates displayed complete contempt for Robert's rules of order. At any moment, at least a half dozen people were yelling into their cameras, trying to drown out the others. 38 different video windows displaying miniature, gesticulating, yelling dervishes floated in the air before me. It would be funny if the fate of the world wasn't resting on this group. Every candidate had the same view as myself, and yet not one was cringing with embarrassment. Oh, there was some consensus, so it wasn't a complete loss. For instance, many groups hated the idea that the USE enclave would be getting off-planet first, even though the USE had been the first to contact us and supplied the plans for the colony ships. Even more groups were incensed at the Spitsbergen group's demand that they be given priority because of their tenuous situation. And everybody was beyond apoplectic that the Brazil group was even allowed in. Brazil was generally considered to have started the war, and everyone was holding a grudge. Couldn't say I entirely disagreed, but most of the people in Florianopolis were under the age of 10 when the war started, if they had been born at all. Nevertheless, Brazil. I looked over at Homer's video feed. He had fallen over, laughing. I spared him a small smile. Over the last little while, I'd started to understand where Homer's humor was coming from. He was laughing less at the people themselves than the utter ridiculousness of the situation. When push came to shove, he'd give his all to help. I decided I'd given them enough rope, time to rein things in. I pressed the override button. Immediately, every delegate's microphone was cut off. Every communicator emitted a loud air horn sound, and every video feed switched to an image of me. Ladies and gentlemen, and I use those terms loosely, we're done for the day. We'll be signing in tomorrow at the same time, but with shiny new rules. Your microphones will only be active when the chairperson, that's me for the moment, recognizes you. If you'd like the other members to watch you having a fit in pantomime, that's fine too. Let me say up front that I don't care if you don't like it. Good night. They hit the end button and all sessions were closed. I leaned back in my chair with a groan while Homer climbed back into his and tried to catch his breath.
Wow, number two, that was intense. Those are some thoroughly pissed off people.
I waved a hand in dismissal. On the one hand, Homer, these are people fighting to get into a lifeboat while the ship sinks. I can sympathize. On the other hand, their behavior is not helping things along.
They're just passengers, Riker, Homer said in a serious tone. They feel helpless. They feel like their fate is being decided by someone else without their input. You need to give them something to do, some way to contribute, some way to feel like they're controlling their destiny at least a little bit.
Huh. That was actually very perceptive. And my opinion of Homer took another small ratchet upwards. My handling of the situation, truthfully, had probably been less than ideal, but this didn't resemble any job description I'd ever had. Homer began to pace, something I don't think I'd ever seen.
Look, Riker, you have to ease up on them. These people are scared. And you aren't giving them any reason to believe that you care about their concerns. You aren't actually the Star Trek character, you know. You need to loosen up a little.
Christ's sake, Homer, you actually think 15 million people are going ballistic because I don't smile enough? I get it about them being scared, but their reactions are their responsibility, not mine. You want to do a comedy routine? Feel free. Bring back your cartoon avatar. That should be good for some laughs. Or not. When you're done, they'll still be at each other's throats, and maybe we can go back to trying to actually fix things. Homer stared at me for a few moments, then shook his head and disappeared. Okay, maybe I'd laid it on a little thick. And I probably owed him an apology, but I just didn't have time for this. The chair recognizes the delegate from Maldives. A green light came on over the delegate's image, and she visibly made an effort not to adjust her clothing.
Mr. Riker, we do not appreciate your high-handed actions yesterday.
She berated me for several minutes. Typical politician. Never use 10 words when 1,000 will do. I waited patiently until she was done, then took the floor. Representative Sharma, I didn't enjoy shutting you down yesterday any more than I enjoy chairing these meetings in general. I'd like the delegates to self-police, but at the same time, there are decisions that must be made in a timely manner. You don't have the luxury of a free-for-all, so here's the thing. I want you, as in the assembly, to decide how a chairperson will be picked, whether they'll have control over the microphones and so on. Once that's done, I will sit back and be just another delegate. How does that sound? There was stunned silence for a moment, then everyone started talking at once. Then another moment of stunned silence as they realized I'd turned on all the microphones, followed by general laughter. When order had been restored, the delegate from the Maldives, still smiling, said,
"Point well taken, Mr. Riker. Leave it to us. We'll hammer something out."
I nodded to her and took myself offline. I looked at my call queue. 12 calls from various delegates awaited me. Wonderful. The first was from the Faith Enclave in San Diego. I really didn't know what to expect. It was generally known that I was a Faith interstellar probe, but I'd been going to great lengths to make it clear that I was a sentient, independent entity. Well, only one way to find out.
Good day, Minister Cranston. What can I do for you?
Good day, Replicant. I wanted to talk to you about your duty.
It's Riker, and I'm very aware of my duty. I have 15 million people depending on me. That's never very far from my mind.
You have a duty to Faith, over and above that. You were built by us. You owe your existence to us. I expect to see our group get a more favorable treatment in the future.
Wow, dude was blunt, anyway.
I hadn't been looking forward to the typical dancing-around-the-point conversation that people called diplomacy. I guess this was better. Sort of.
Not going to happen, Minister.
That's not your decision, Replicant.
Well, actually it is. That's what comes from being an independent, sentient entity, and you might want to work on your social skills. Good day, Minister.
Before he could respond, I cut off the connection.
The next one was from the leader of the Spitsbergen Island Refuge. This would be a difficult conversation. The Spitz Enclave would very likely be the first place to become uninhabitable.
Good day, Mr. Walter.
Gudmund Walter blinked owlishly at the video. Ex-military, he had an abrupt style that would have sunk him in traditional politics, but that was well-suited for this post-apocalyptic world.
Good day, Mr. Eicher. I, of course, am calling to press the case for my people. You have hopefully by now received our food production projections for the winter upcoming. It is not well, not well at all.
I know, Mr. Walter, and I reiterate that I will not let people starve. However, bumping your group up in the emigration queue isn't the answer. That's still maybe a decade off. We should be concentrating on more short-term solutions.
Hope is part of that short-term solution, sir. We can hold on if we know there is an end in the sight. At the moment, most of my people expect to be dead one way or another before our turn comes.
I pinched the bridge of my nose and sighed. The Spitz were a relatively small group, perhaps 4,000 people who had managed to survive on the island of Spitsbergen. Their techniques were impressive, involving intensive agriculture during the Arctic summers, combined with seal hunting and reindeer herding to provide enough calories. But the deteriorating climate was making their job harder every year. They might have another decade or two at most before it became impossible.
Mr. Eicher, have you knowledge of the Svalbard Global Seed Vault and the Svalbard Global Genetic Diversity Vault?
The name was familiar. I did a quick library dive. The Svalbard Global Seed Vault had been built in 2008, which was why I'd heard of it. It was intended as a backup seed bank for other national seed banks. According to the library, in 2025, the Svalbard Trust had expanded the mandate of the seed vault to include all species of plant, domesticated or not, from dandelions to sequoias. They'd also established the genetic diversity vault to store animal genetic material. I was stunned and sat frozen for almost 100 milliseconds. This was huge, and Walter knew it. The viability of a colony would increase tremendously with even a fraction of what was in those vaults. Assuming they were still there. Walter wouldn't have noticed my hesitation at the human timescale. Yes, I'm familiar with it from the historical records, sir. Is it still in existence?
It is, sir. Unlike, I would imagine, most of the other vaults around the planet. We did not get rocks and nuclear weapons dropped on us.
So, I was pretty sure there was a punchline coming.
So the utility is obvious for colonists. We have it. You need it. Unless you can find one of the other vaults. Think on that, Mr. Eicher. Assume any implied threat you care to. We will discuss this further in a few days upcoming.
And with that, Mr. Walter nodded to me, reached forward out of frame, and ended the connection. Well, that was one fine pickle. I looked at the remaining calls still on hold. I couldn't see any that needed immediate handling, so I instructed Guppy to take a message from each and to promise that I would phone them back. Guppy made an excellent secretary/receptionist. His appearance was off-putting enough so that people didn't stay online long, and he was absolutely unfazed by bullying, threats, bribery, or insults. Great poker face, too. I sent out a connection request to Colonel Butterworth. This was going to be one of those good news, bad news things. 34. Homer, September 2158, Saul.
My God, what a putz. Of course Riker was having problems with the enclaves. The man was a humorless, rigid martinet with a pole up his butt. Every time he opened his mouth, he offended someone. Original Bob had always made a point of mocking people who took themselves too seriously. It amazed me that Riker wasn't able to make the connection. It was obvious that I was more like Original Bob than he was. And now the Spitz had delivered an ultimatum. Okay, that was a real problem, and I couldn't blame Mr. Pooh for getting bent out of shape about it, but there had to be a better tactic than frontal assault. I paced around my VR, hands behind my back, for a few milliseconds. Bet Riker does this. The thought made me shudder. I popped up a Nerf basketball in a hoop and began taking shots while I pondered. I noted idly that the trajectory of the basketball wasn't realistic. Yeah, the VR needs work. Who has time? Walter demanded a place for his people on the first ships, but did he really need to be on the first Shifts? Or did he just want to be out early? What would be acceptably early? I pulled up the manufacturing schedule and gazed at it. You know, ship 3 isn't that far behind 1 and 2, and with some adjustments. The thought had possibilities, but Riker would just dismiss the idea out of hand if I brought it up. Did he even realize what an arrogant ass he had turned into? He listened to Colonel Butterworth, though.
Yeah, that's the ticket. Smiling to myself, I made a call. 35. Bob, July 2165, Delta Eridani. The Deltans are under attack. I looked up at the call from Marvin. I'd been checking in with the auto factory to make sure everything was on track. Quickly, I suspended the auto factory link and brought up all Deltan feeds to the foreground. A group of what looked sort of like the natives was attacking one of the tribal hearths. Most of the males were off hunting, and the few that had been left to guard were having a hard time of it. The attackers were similar to the Deltans the same way a gorilla is similar to a human, both in size and strength. They didn't employ weapons at all, just teeth, claws, and overwhelming aggression. I watched in horror as one of the attackers ripped open the throat of a defender with its teeth. The gorilloids concentrated on taking down individuals. They didn't seem to be trying to take over the encampment or steal anything. As a Deltan was taken down, several gorilloids would drag the body away, fighting over it. I started to have a really bad feeling. The attack was over in a couple of minutes. One gorilloid had been killed when enough Deltans managed to get pointed sticks into it, but 6 Deltans were gone. In a war of attrition, the gorilloids would win. I ordered one of the drones to follow the gorilloids. They headed into the dense forest and split up, each group dragging a Deltan body. There didn't seem to be any organization. In fact, the longer I watched them, the more certain I was that there was nothing more than animal intelligence there. When the drone caught up with one of the groups, I found them tearing the body of the Deltan apart and eating it. I hadn't felt that ill since I died. I looked around in my VR. The other Bobs had been following the whole thing. I noticed that Marvin looked especially upset, and I raised my eyebrows at him. He looked around at the rest of us and shrugged. This kind of explains what I've found while I've been looking around. I've discovered a number of abandoned Deltan camps, and the farther they are from the current camp, the longer it's been since they were abandoned. I think the gorilloids have been hunting the Deltans for a long time, and the gorilloids are winning. Luke piped up. Bender and I have been venturing farther afield, and we haven't found any other large tribes of Deltans. We've run into occasional small family groups, but they're nomadic and inhabiting marginal territory. So they're being hunted to extinction, I said. There were several seconds of silence before Bender spoke up, probably trying to be funny. Remember the Prime Directive. Luke looked at him in disgust.
Right, when people show up in 100 years and we have to explain to them that they missed meeting the only other sentient race we've ever found by less than a century, I'm sure they'll be mollified by the knowledge that we didn't break a fictional law from a TV show.
Bender turned away, upset, and Luke seemed surprised at his outburst.
Sorry.
Marvin looked over at me. It's a fair question, though. How much exactly are we going to interfere, Prime Directives notwithstanding? There are real examples from Earth history of cultural contamination and outright extinguishment.
I consider it a given that we're not going to let them die out, I answered, looking down at my hands. For some reason, I couldn't keep them still.
Anxiety?
I don't have an answer beyond that, Marvin.
What are we going to do, though? Set up armed drones around the perimeter? Become some kind of sky god that protects them?
Marvin looked from one person to the next, waiting for an answer.
Luke spoke up before I could respond.
This is the type of environmental pressure that forces swift evolution. In fact, they may be becoming intelligent specifically because of the gorilloids. Maybe we have to let nature take its course.
I turned to Guppy, who as usual was standing at parade rest over to the side.
I think I caught him by surprise, and I was positive that I had detected active interest in his expression and posture before he quickly went into fishy poker face.
Guppy, what's the total population of Deltans at the campfire sites?
412, allowing for today's deaths.
I turned back to the group. That's down below estimates of the low point for humanity back in Africa. I don't think we have any leeway to just let things go.
So we're back to guarding them with drones, Bender said.
They're at the rock and pointy stick stage. That's not good enough to hold off the gorilloids.
Not all of them, I countered. You've seen Archimedes. That kid is smart.
Marvin pulled up a map. Speaking of which, sort of, I found the flint source. One of the old villages, and interestingly, there's some worked flint there and in a couple of villages nearby. I think at least some